First of all, I want to thank you for the warmth of your invitation to come here and indeed for the kindness that's already been shown to me this morning. What I want to try to do today is to focus upon a biblical theme. So we are not going to focus upon one particular portion of Scripture, but we are going to freely range through different portions. So I will not damage you by making you do all the work of flicking between pages. I will try to remember most of the portions of Scripture that I will bring before you, and hope that you may be able to do something similar later on. But as a starting point, I want us to turn to John's Gospel and the 14th chapter. I'm not sure that I'm as clever as my predecessor to sort out all these pages that are down there on the desk before me, but if you've got this old blue one, then you'll need something like page 1082. But it's John chapter 14, fairly easy to find. Most of you will know the context of this. Jesus Christ is preparing for his death upon the cross. He's also preparing his disciples for that death, and they are distraught and bewildered by the message that he has been bringing to them. And then he comes with these very comforting words that we find at the opening of chapter 14. And we're going to read together just verses 1 to 6. Jesus says, "Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. Trust also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I am going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the way to the place where I am going." Thomas said to him, "Lord, we don't know where you are going, so how can we know the way?" Jesus answered, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." When Simon phoned through last night, well, he seemed to be on the phone most of the day, actually, one way or another. When he phoned me last evening and he asked for the hymn numbers, I gave him the hymn numbers, and then I got the message back at breakfast this morning via Paul. I don't know if Simon fed this into his mind or what, but certainly Paul knew by then that the theme was going to be heaven. And that was obvious to him quite properly. It was obvious to him by the reading of the hymns. We are going to try to focus upon the theme of heaven, both this morning and for those of us that can gather together this evening once again then. Christians have always believed in the existence of heaven as a real place to which they go when they die. But as you know as well as I, there is a great deal of skepticism about the existence not only of heaven but any kind of afterlife. I think also that there is a measure of confusion, at least it seems to me that's the case, when you listen to Christians talking about their eternal expectations. There's some confusion in their minds as to what it is they're actually going to know and enjoy. And I want to try to add some help to these questions. I don't want to confuse you anymore, although I know that it's possible I might actually end up doing that, but I will do my best to make this subject a little clearer. And particularly, I want to focus upon three questions. The first question will be this one, and this is the one that we will spend the whole of this morning upon. The question that we're going to face this morning is, why do Christians believe in heaven? Simple, straightforward, why do Christians believe in heaven? And then, God willing, this evening we'll turn our attention to two other questions. The first of these will be, what will heaven be like? And we will spend most of our time on this. And you'll see why I think when we are getting together and we are focusing upon this particular subject and question, and especially then when we move on to the third and the final question, which will be, how do we get into heaven? I think you'll realize then why it is that we're giving less time and attention to this than to the previous two questions. It's not that it is less important, but I think what we have said running up to that last question has already set in place a number of issues that help us to understand the answer to that question. But this morning we're going to focus upon this one very simple question. Why do Christians believe in heaven? Skeptics, of course, have always poked fun at the Christian belief in heaven. If you are roughly around my age, and I hope you haven't got to that great age yet, but if you're roughly around my age, you'll be familiar with the kind of statements that men and women have constantly made to Christians during the course of the past century or so. Heaven, they say, a Christian view of heaven is really a bit like pie in the sky when you die. If you were at all influenced by Marxist theory, then you would be aware of the fact that the great belief was amongst them that heaven and this place to which Christians expect to go and enjoy themselves at the end of life is really simply the opiate of the people. It's a kind of drug to help people get through this life with all its trials and troubles, and at the same time it keeps them in their place. They don't have to expect too much out of life because they'll get everything once they die. So the idea being that this is some sort of drug to help you get through that. When Zorelia and I first came back to the United Kingdom in 1971, because by then we were a married couple, and a married man is expected to provide, or at least he did in those old days, is expected to provide for his family. And we came back penniless from Portugal, as you do. And I had to somehow feed this woman with an enormous appetite. So it meant I had to get a job. And I got a job, and very soon I began to talk to people about the gospel, as, again, Christian people have a tendency to do. Lunch breaks particularly were a time when, at least at the beginning, they thought it was eat the Christian time. You know, that sort of blood sport, beginning way back with the Romans and running right the way up to the modern time. And we found that it was more a question of the Christian getting indigestion on the fare of the non-Christians rather than the other way around. And there used to be one particular individual who, for a little while, couldn't actually answer the questions or cope with the answers that I was giving. So he took a completely different tack. And his approach was to sing a song that was very popular at that time. He would sing it almost ad nauseum around the place, hoping that he would upset me in some particular way by it. And the lyrics, unfortunately, I've never forgotten the lyrics. You know, you carry a lot of junk around in your head during the course of life, don't you? And I've got lots of that in my head. And a part of that junk is this particular line. And it went like this. I'm told it's been reintroduced into the world, poor world. But the line went something like this. Everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. You can get the idea of where he was going with that. But he stopped. He stopped after I thanked him very much for reminding us that of his conviction that everybody wanted to heaven, and I presume that included him. And it's quite natural for no one to actually want to die. When God made us in his image, he made us as beings that were destined for everlastingness. And of course, an everlasting being doesn't want to die. That's one of the traumas of just being a human being. But yes, if you're in your right mind, everybody wants to go to heaven. In more recent times, we've been reminded of this afresh in another way with the celebration of what would have been. It's a strange, the kind of things that we celebrate in our world. But we've been reminded that if John Lennon had lived, he would have reached the grand old age of 70 by now. And of course, Lenin became very well known for what became a kind of humanistic anthem through his song Imagine. You know how it begins, imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell beneath us, above us only sky. And that was the kind of anthem that was very popular, and of course he sung it so cleverly. The music is so haunting that men and women took it upon themselves to rejoice in this kind of humanistic agenda. But really it was another way of poking fun at the Christian conviction that at the end of life there is no real end, that there is an eternity to be faced. But nevertheless, that skepticism is constant. It's found in the media, it's found in the literature that we read. It's constantly being thrust at us one way or another. And yet, I want to say to you that Christians, despite all of this, persist in believing in the existence not only of an afterlife, but of heaven itself. Why? I think that there are two main responses to make to that particular question. And the first may surprise you, the second won't, but the first will surprise you, perhaps. Because despite all the skepticism, it is not easy to rid ourselves, whoever we are, of the conviction that some sort of afterlife exists. It's just very, very difficult to do that. We may try hard to do so, but it's difficult, extremely difficult. Our minds and our hearts are quite stubborn in maintaining belief in an afterlife or some sort of heaven. And it's not just Christians, is it? Non-Christians who hold to some form of religion often have some sort of afterlife as the great goal and aspiration of their existence. And strangely enough, even amongst non-Christians, you find the same conviction almost escaping them before they can drag the conviction back into their mouths. Given certain circumstances, they find themselves betraying something that seems to be deeply written within all that they are. I want to try to explore and remind you of this. Through some of the greatest writings and testimonies that have come down to us through our history. One of the earliest written testimonies to this concern about an afterlife, of course, is found in the Old Testament book of Job. It's found many times, but there's one place where Job, with all his sufferings, which have become somewhat proverbial, those sufferings pressing down upon him, and he wrestling with this eternal concern, and Job saying, "When I die, will I live again?" The interesting thing about that statement is this, that when Job says it, as the words that quickly follow after the question reveal, he was convinced that there was a life. But he's also aware of the fact that there are circumstances in life where everything presses in upon you, when even your most dearly cherished beliefs can be called into question. Or you think of William Shakespeare. I'm not a great fan of William Shakespeare. I have staggered through a number of his plays, and I like some more than others, but Shakespeare places the same concern on the lips of one of his characters. I'm referring, of course, to Hamlet, in one of those, probably the most well-known of all the quotations. The first time I read Hamlet was on a burning beach in Portugal. Come to think of it, I also read Dante's Inferno the same year in the same place, which was probably more appropriate. But in Hamlet, you've got in Hamlet, you have Hamlet, the hero, musing on the question of suicide. And the words that come from his lips are, to be or not to be. In other words, sometimes such are the troubles of life. So heavy do they seem to press upon us. You know, the kind of experience that you have in your life when there's a great heaviness, an ache upon your chest, and it goes down to your stomach and it produces something that feels like a physical pain. And in the midst of those very difficult, traumatic experiences, sometimes for some people, suicide seems the only option. Why go on with this? The pain is too much. Let's just get out of the whole thing. And what is it that stops some people going that extra distance? Well, it's the uncertainty. The uncertainty of knowing whether if I was to end my life, whether I would really be removing the pain. How do you know? Whatever it is you're stepping into beyond this life, the other life might actually produce something worse. You can't be sure that that isn't the case. And thankfully, some people step back from the brink simply because of the realization that they don't have a foolproof answer to the question of their ultimate destiny. Sorry, this is going to sound like a Daniel Webber confession of favorite writings. There's no way of avoiding this. I'm just hoping you don't have the same agonies of mind that I do. But for a while I used to carry around with me, with my Bible in one pocket, and I used to carry in the other pocket, just for relaxation purposes, a little volume of selections of Plato. It became a close friend of mine as I used to travel around Europe. And I like Plato. I like the way that he struggles with things that too often I don't seem to have mind big enough to be able to deal with. And you find in Plato, look, a man without the Bible. A man who, as far as we know, has no contact with the Old Testament. He's living hundreds of years before the birth of Jesus Christ. And all he has is his mind and his experience of the world in which he lives. And he wants answers to a particular question. He wants to know whether or not there are any clues in this world in which we live that would suggest that we are immortal, that we survive death. And he came up with a number of clues, just by thinking, just by his experience with the world in which he lived. He thought, for example, of the seasons of the year. In the Ball household, over these last couple of mornings, we've been rejoicing in the sight of the sunshine. You know, you almost get to a point where you despair of it ever showing its face again in the sky, don't you, when everything is just appallingly grey. I know that doesn't fit in with A.W. Pink's view of how you should say things, but I'm not too bothered about that. Some of us like to see the sun in the sky. We like to feel its warmth upon us. And when it's not there, we feel bereft. And see this sun, and it almost makes you think that winter isn't approaching until you step outside and the temperature has dropped down to about 3 or 4 and you know that it's going to be worse. But Plato observed the same universe that we did. He experienced the same changes that we experience in our world. The changing of the seasons, the way that spring is followed by summer and summer by autumn and autumn by winter. And the whole thing goes back again and it keeps on repeating this cycle. And he began to say to himself, well, maybe this is a picture of something. Or what I am not. A gardener picks up a seed, you know, you buy these seeds and they look so innocuous, don't they? Little dead things. And what do we do with them? We dig a hole in the floor ground and we put the seed in the ground and we cover it up, we bury it. We pour water on it. We hope sunshine is going to somehow do something to that piece of earth and to that little something in the ground. And what are we waiting for? We're waiting for life to emerge from it, from the signs of life to emerge from that which has been buried. that seems dead and is buried. Plato thought about that. He also thought about the butterfly and its origins. This little worm that entombs itself, that wraps itself up in its own coffin, only to emerge eventually as one of the most beautiful of all the creatures upon the face of the earth. And Plato drew this conclusion. He said, look, I don't believe that this conclusively proves that man is immortal. But the skeptic ought to be very careful when he sees these things, that he doesn't easily just dismiss them. They may be pointing to something. Another person who has influenced the modern world more, perhaps, at least at the level of thinking, than any other person, was the 18th century Immanuel Kant. It's interesting that he too was interested in and thinking about the same kind of issues and problems that went in and out of the mind of Plato, and he came to similar conclusions. But he came at it from a different angle. He began thinking about justice. Isn't it strange, he says, that everyone in the world believes in justice? Now, they may not say they believe that formally, but if I can give you a simple illustration, if you were to walk out of here this morning and you were to see someone walking along the street, you know, going along with their Sunday newspapers, and you were to march across to the other side of the road and then you were to kick them in their shins. Now, I'm not, you know, this is not sort of general advice for what you're to do post Sunday morning service, but if you were to do that, the response would be anger at the very least. It may well be more. There is a sense of injustice. Why did you do such a thing? There is this sense that there is something wrong about those actions. And Kant recognized this. And he said, but you know, justice is not always a reality in this world. Crooks do get away with their crookery. People do get away with things. They are never seemingly brought to justice. And then he concluded this, that if our deeply held convictions about justice are not to be regarded as meaningless, then we must survive the grave. In other words, there must be a place of ultimate justice. There must be a judge, an ultimate judge. He didn't claim that he knew this for certain, but he chose to believe it. Why? Because the alternative to him was unthinkable. It would reduce the whole of life to a joke. And that was unthinkable. Or, finally, let me just come back to what I said earlier on. You think of our modern funerals. You know, as you get older, one of the things that happens more and more often is that you find yourself attending funerals. Your friends, relatives, neighbours, it's just part of life that these things become more regular in your experience. When you go to a Christian's funeral, most of the time, as a kind of compensation for your sadness and your grief, there is this realization that beyond death, there is life, everlasting life. For the Christian, there is life such as they have never known or enjoyed it before. And there is, in the midst then of all this sorrow, there is not just consolation, but there is comfort and there is hope and there is even a measure of joy. When you go to a non-Christian's funeral, sometimes you have hope of a sort, but it's generally quite irrational. Most of the time, people don't really know what to do with someone who has no expectation for the future. And they themselves may share in that inability to see beyond what has happened, the awfulness of death. And yet sometimes in the midst of all of this, because of the need to say something that appears to be comforting rather than nothing at all, you find strange things escaping their lips. Things like this. Oh well, he or she is in a far better place now. You know, if it wasn't so impolite, you would like to ask, what makes you say that? What's your reason for saying? But they say this, and they say things like it, because there seems to be lurking in all of us a capacity to imagine a better life, a better world, a life where there is no death and no pain. And it's very interesting that the Old Testament tells us why this exists. In the third chapter of the book of Ecclesiastes, and in verse 11, you have these wonderful words. God has made everything beautiful in its time. He has placed eternity in our hearts. If you've got the King James Version in front of you, you've got so many versions here, I guess you must have everything covered. Let me try to assure you that the better translation of the original is actually eternity. Not just because I prefer it, it actually is. One of the few things that are known better now than they were known in the 16th and 17th century is the knowledge of Hebrew. That's why all the modern versions that I'm acquainted with translate this in that particular way. God has made everything beautiful in its time. He has placed eternity in our hearts. In other words, what that writer of so many years ago was saying was this: we have been made in such a way we cannot escape the fact that we are made for more than the few years of this earthly life. We were made for eternity, and there is always something yearning for the eternal within us. And so I say to you this: one of the reasons that Christians persist in believing in heaven is because we know from experience, and experience beyond our own, that most men and women find it incredibly difficult to rid themselves of the notion that some kind of afterlife exists. There's a second reason, and for this reason resonates with Christians probably much more than the first. The main reason why Christians believe in an afterlife and in heaven itself is because of the consistent testimony of the Bible. Christians are persuaded that there is good reason to believe that in addition to what we learn from nature, from the use of our minds and from our experience, the Christian is persuaded with good reason God has spoken. God has revealed things to us that we could never discover of ourselves. It's usually just making nature clearer. It's giving fuller and clearer and more open descriptions of what nature only can intent. And what God has said has been preserved for us by this same God in what we call His Word. the Bible. And so, we find when we turn to the Bible, we find more than just a hint of this teaching in the Old Testament. Sometimes it's alleged that there is little expectation of eternity or heaven at all in the Old Testament. It's another one of those cases where some modern scholars seem to like to read the Bible with at least one eye closed. Because the Old Testament does refer to this again and again and again. For example, and these are just a few examples to make the point, or to illustrate the point. When you turn to 2 Chronicles in chapter 2, you find the writer there speaking about what is sometimes translated as the highest heaven or the heaven of heavens. And the reason he speaks about heaven in this way is to distinguish the ultimate heaven from the atmosphere immediately around us and what we now refer to as outer space. And there is clear in those Old Testament minds a conviction that there is a place where God is, and he is supreme and more there in his glory than anywhere else. So when you read the prophets, you find Isaiah in chapter 63 speaking about God as someone who looks down from heaven. It knows all about the difficulties of up, down, and sideways. But language has to be used in some way to convey to us something that is true but far beyond anything that we can fully understand. And God, he says, looks down from heaven. Or you think of the psalm that we read, the version of the psalm that we sang together, Psalm 23. There the psalmist speaks about us dwelling in the house of the Lord forever. Heaven isn't always simply described as heaven. It's sometimes described as the house of the Lord. Or in Psalm 73, there's a beautiful section in Psalm 73 that I am actually going to read. Psalm 73. Here is the psalmist. He's faced with the realization that wicked people often seem to have a better life than those of us that profess to be religious or Christian. And he's trying to work his way through this. And then he comes to this conclusion as he gets towards the end. He says, "Yet," this is verse 23, "yet I am always with you. You hold me by my right hand. You guide me with your counsel. And afterwards, you will take me into glory." What's glory? It's heaven. "You will take me into glory." And then he says this, "Whom have I in heaven but you? And earth has nothing I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever." So on the night that Jesus is born in Bethlehem, angels greet the birth. They announce the birth. And what do they say or sing before the shepherds? "Glory to God in the highest." It's just reflecting that Old Testament teaching. The New Testament, of course, is replete with the expectation of heaven. So you turn to Paul's second letter to the Corinthians in chapter 12, and you find him speaking about it as the third heaven. Or you turn to Philippians chapter 1, and still Paul is speaking there, and he's saying something that appears to many people to be absurd. He says that dying is gain. How can dying be gain? He even goes on to say that to die is simply to make way for a place that is far better, or better by far, as one translation has it. And that's heaven. dying is gain because what I am going to is so much better than anything that I've ever known here. And he's not taking in the opium. He's not just consoling himself in the face of the possible death that awaits him. He's not doing that at all. He's someone who is saying, I know, he says, that beyond this life, there is something far better than the greatest joy that I've ever known here upon earth. Better by far. Or you turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Isn't it interesting? In our evangelical churches, we often turn to 1 Corinthians 15 at about Easter time. We are keen to defend the real resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. So we turn up 1 Corinthians 15 and we focus upon that passage. And of course, there's nothing wrong in doing that. But what we need to remember is this. When Paul wrote to the Corinthians, he knew that all the Corinthian believers already believed in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So he isn't proving to them that Jesus Christ really escaped the grave. He knows that they all believe this already. You can't actually be a Christian without this conviction. So what is he doing? He's responding to another concern that they have. These very clever, scientifically minded Corinthian believers of the first century knew what happened to a body when it died and you placed it in the tomb. They knew that it became dust, and their problem was a very practical one. Look, Paul, if you speak about the resurrection of the body, if you speak about the resurrection of the dead, if we have the right to this expectation, how can it possibly happen? We become like dust. The whole of that chapter is to emphasize the fact that just as Jesus Christ was raised from the dead as the kind of first fruits, we too who believe in him will be raised up again. John, in his book of Revelation, we'll turn to that this evening, speaks of a new heaven and a new earth. It found an echo in the prayer that was mentioned or spoken earlier this morning. The New Testament then is replete with this expectation. But Jesus Christ is the foremost witness, our foremost witness to the existence of heaven. I think many Christian people really believe in heaven because of him and because of his testimony. In John's Gospel, 6th chapter, he speaks about he is the one who comes from heaven. What an offensive thing that was to say to those first century Jews. And yet he says it, and he says it with great boldness. He is the one who comes down from heaven. People began to desert him in droves after hearing this. But that's what he said. When he encouraged his disciples to pray, how did he begin? Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. In John 14 that we read together, just as a kind of prefix to what we've been saying, he speaks about his death, preparing a place for his disciples. I'm going away. I must go away. He's not talking about going into heaven, incidentally, and actually building a place. He's talking about his death being the means by which he is preparing heaven for us. Because we can only get into heaven by trusting in the merits of the perfect sacrificial Lamb of God, Jesus Christ, who takes away the sin of the world. He's hanging upon a cross. And he speaks to a dying thief alongside him. What does he say? Today you will be with me in paradise. And the book of Hebrews says that when he had died and when he was raised, what happens then? He ascends into heaven and he sits at the right hand of his Father. And my friends, the reason we believe in heaven ultimately is because of him. We believe in heaven, partially at least, because it is very difficult to get this whole idea out of our mind, out of our existence. We may try, many of us before we were converted, we tried very hard, but it keeps on arising. It's the way God has made us. But then this God who made us speaks to that which he has made. And all through the rolling years of this world, this consistent testimony has sounded forth from Old Testament prophets, from New Testament apostles, from the Word made flesh, Jesus Christ himself. And because we believe in him, we have this hope firmly before us. My friends, I have a simple question to put before you this morning. Do you believe in heaven? Do you believe in heaven? Do you know why you believe in heaven? Let me venture another question. Are you living as if heaven really is your destiny? Whether life is tough or whether you enjoy it, there's nothing wrong in enjoying life. God has granted it to us. But do you look to the future with even greater hopes and greater longings, greater expectations? And do you seek by the grace of God so to conduct your life now that it is evident that you are amongst the many in this world throughout the ages who have placed heaven before themselves and followed hard